You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And we're very lucky to have a great panel today on a very interesting and controversial topic that is becoming more and more in the news, more and more controversial. All three of the panelists were part of a task force, Purdue Special Pardee Task Force report on global capital flows. I'll just introduce the panelists and then say a few words about the topic and hand it over to them before we enter a discussion. Kevin Gallagher is Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University, where he's also a faculty fellow at the Pardee Center for the Study of the Long-Range Future. He is one of the co-chairs of the task force, which prepared the report, along with Jose Antonio and Stephanie Griffith-Jones, which put together this report entitled Regulating Global Capital Flows for Long-Run Development. Kevin, in 2009, served on the Investment Subcommittee of the U.S. State Department's Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy. He currently serves on the National Advisory Committee to NAFTA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and as a member of the Inter-American Dialogues China and Latin America Working Group. He writes prolifically, and I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, have read him. Professor Jose Antonio Ocampo is a professor at Columbia and director of the Economic and Political Development Program at the School of International and Public Affairs there. I have the great honor, pleasure to co-teach a course with him in the fall. In 2009, Jose Antonio served as a member of the Commission of Experts of the UN General Assembly on Reforms of the International Monetary and Financial System. He was three times minister in his own country in Colombia, finance, national planning, and agriculture and rural development. He served in a number of positions in the UN, notably as UN Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs and Executive Secretary of the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. Jose Antonio has published extensively on macroeconomic theory and policy, international financial issues, economic and social development, trade, and Colombian and Latin American economic history. He studied at Notre Dame and received his PhD from Yale. And he was one of the two candidates supported by the developing countries in the race for the World Bank, as you all know. Stephanie Griffith-Jones is the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She is a member of the Warwick Commission on Financial Regulation and was a professorial fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex. She has published very widely on this and other topics in the international financial system and its reform. And she really is a towering figure in this field. She received her PhD from Cambridge. So this is the wonderful panel we have. We also had the Brazilian executive director from the IMF, but he was called by his minister to New York, so we're missing one of the original panelists. The topic is receiving increasing attention. Capital flows now obviously dominate trade in terms of sheer magnitude. They're huge, and not only huge, they're extremely rapid. And there are very interesting topics relating to governance, to democracy versus capital flows, to the pressure they put on democratic systems. You all remember probably when George Papandreou of Greece had the idea of submitting the package of reforms to a referendum. It went very well, but you know, one of the dominant arguments against it was that in 24 hours capital markets would create complete havoc, whereas even the fastest political campaign on a referendum needed at least a few weeks. Can't hold a political campaign in hours or days. So there's this gap between the speed of capital flows and the time a democratic political process takes. There is the volatility and pro-cyclicality that has been demonstrated again and again in capital flows. The quick, sudden stops, reversals that create huge problems, particularly for smaller countries, but increasingly even for the larger countries. There is the issue of their effectiveness. You know, if we talk about capital control, what are we really talking about specifically? Is it so easy? There are those who argue that they can be easily circumvented. I think there's the broader issue of putting that into the context of capital flows management, and I think the topic is not just capital controls, but it's really capital flows management, macroprudential management, macroeconomic policy relating to it, as well as specific measures dealing with capital flows. And then I think there's the interesting topic as to whether, there are those who would still argue, let them as free as possible. It's interesting to note that some people who are extremely pro-free trade, like Jagdish Bhagwati, for example, at Colombia, is much more reluctant on free capital flows, much more cautious. So arguments for free trade don't necessarily go together with arguments of free capital flows, but there are those who are for very free capital flows, who believe that that allocates resources quickly and optimally across the globe. Then there are those who say, well, you know, every country should have the right to regulate its own flows and create the policy space for itself, for its macroeconomic policy and monetary policy, by having whatever controls it feels is best for itself on capital controls. But then there are also those who argue, well, you need some system, but if everybody does something different, you could get beggar thy neighbor policies, you could get a very suboptimal outcome, and rather than just, you know, letting countries determine their own regime, would it not be better to have a global set of rules a little bit like trade rules, that allow some space, but that try to avoid some of the disadvantages of a very fragmented system. So I think these are some of the different views, and the IMF has actually come from a position, as you know, of totally free capital flows to a position, let's have a worldwide system that is quite freedom of capital oriented, but has some exceptions and some rules that are there. So which is quite a move, but which is not yet, I mean, not a move for very systematic anti-cyclical framework. So I think these are some of the topics we'll hear about. I don't want to take more time and hand it over as the first speaker to Kevin.
Thank you, Minister, for hosting us here at Brookings and for that kind introduction. I'll give some context to the task force report and pull out some of our key recommendations and let my colleagues go into some of these issues in more depth. Second to the Eurozone crisis, perhaps the most important or most concerning occurrence in the world economy in the wake of the financial crisis has been the volatility of cross-border financial flows to emerging markets and developing countries. With low interest rates and low growth in the industrialized world, when that's paired with relatively higher interest rates and higher growth in the rich world, in the developing world, that's created the incentive for lots of cross-border financial flows to emerging markets and developing countries. And that became particularly acute in between the time about 2009 and late 2011. But then once the third quarter of 2011 came along and there was real Eurozone jitters, there was a sudden stop and a lot of capital turned around and came back to the quote-unquote safety of the U.S. market. But since then, those structural changes are still in place, with low interest rates in the north and higher interest rates in the south and faster growth in the south. And so there's been a continuance again of rapid capital flows to developing countries. This has caused lots of currency appreciation. It's caused asset bubbles. There's been associated lack of international competitiveness in a lot of countries, lots of job losses and real fears about deindustrialization and the possibility of financial crises. The Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has been making the rounds lately, first in Germany, then at the BRICS summit, and last week here in the United States, referring to this phenomenon as the liquidity tsunami, which is coming from the industrialized countries and wreaking havoc in developing country markets. During this period, three landmark events occurred that really motivate this task force and the work that we did. One is in between 2010 and 2011, both the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the National Bureau of Economic Research came out with rigorous studies showing that those countries that regulated cross-border finance in the run-up to the crisis were among the least hard hit. And in fact, that regulating cross-border finance should be an important part of a macroeconomic toolkit to try to prevent and mitigate crises. A second key development is in this period, 2009, in the wake of the global financial crisis, many emerging market and developing countries were so bold to go ahead and regulate cross-border finance on their own. Brazil, South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, Peru, Costa Rica, the list goes on. And third, concerned about what he referred to as the chaotic use of cross-border regulations for financial flows, when French President Nicolas Sarkozy took over as the head of the G20, he tasked the IMF with creating a quote-unquote code of conduct to help countries decide when is it appropriate to use capital regulations and when not. And that's where we come in. In this turbulent period, we put together a task force of experts that have been working on this issue for a long time to monitor global capital flows, monitor the work of the IMF, and try to help policymakers make sense of this turbulent time and to put together the right kind of policy approaches to respond. So we put together an expert task force that is chaired by the three of us, but also included the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank of India, the executive director to the IMF from Brazil, senior economist from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, economist from the United Nations Development, United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, the Asian Development Bank Institute, the G24, folks from across the street at the Peterson Institute, and a number of academics. And if you take a look at the report, you were all offered a free copy up at the front. There's still a handful of copies available. If not, you can get a copy on PDF either from the Boston University webpage at the Pardee Center, the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University, which is a co-sponsor of the project, their webpage, or IPD at Columbia. Each essay has a number of policy recommendations, but I'm going to just end here by pulling out the five that are perhaps the most important or most targeted towards the IMF discussions that are going on here in town over the next couple days. And I'd say the sort of five key findings and policy recommendations in that vein. First and foremost, the task force really stresses the importance and legitimacy of including the regulation of cross-border finance in global discussions about re-regulating finance after the financial crisis. Much of the discussion has been about what national governments should do at home, but what's surprisingly absent from the discussion is the need to regulate cross-border finance. Second, the task force is very critical of the IMF code of conduct that came out to tell countries when they should and should not use capital account regulations, and we offer an alternative set of rules of thumb for developing countries to think about. Third, rather than telling countries when or whether to use capital account regulations, we think there's a real role for the IMF in helping countries identify best practices, helping countries design the right kinds of regulations. As the minister said, there's often an issue with circumvention to help police or to help monitor the use of the regulations and so forth. Fourth, that there's been too much emphasis or too much of the burden on regulating cross-border capital flows has been put on the emerging markets and developing countries who are the recipients of much of the flows. And that we argue, and one of our discussions today will really talk about this more in depth. We argue that the proper regulation of cross-border capital flows should occur at both ends, not by countries that are receiving capital inflows, but also countries where the source of capital outflows come from. And fifth, we recommend that the IMF conduct a review of the extent to which the proliferation of trade and investment treaties are making it more difficult for countries to regulate capital flows and for countries to cooperate. The IMF Articles of Agreement, 1944, Article 6, gives countries the freedom to regulate capital flows under the capital account as they see fit. However, if you've signed on to certain portions of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, or if you have a bilateral investment treaty or a free trade area with the United States, it's increasingly difficult to both regulate cross-border capital flows and cooperate in those regulations. So those are some of the five key policy recommendations, and now I'll let my colleagues go into a little bit more depth on these.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And Jose Antonio?
Yeah, thank you, Kemal, and thank you for hosting and sharing this this session. Let me concentrate on the recipient side and what policies you know, countries have to regulate these capital flows. And let me say that the basic problem from the point of view of emerging markets and developing countries is that the capital flows are strongly procyclical. In the sense, you get too much of them when you know, in good times, and too little in bad times. But beyond that, you know, one of the major issues that had been discussed for a long time is that they actually limit the room of maneuver to do countercyclical policies. I mean, for example, in the guidelines, you know, approved by the IMF, there is actually say, well, you get too much capital, reduce your interest rates. Well, that's exactly the opposite what you want to do at that time, because you're booming. You know, your domestic economy is booming. You actually should increase capital, you know, your interest rate. But, you know, by doing that, you actually get more floods of capital, more, you know, the tsunami gets worse. So you have to develop new instruments that not only allow you to do countercyclical policy, but they have to be different in some cases from traditional countercyclical macroeconomic policy. So the role of these regulations is actually, or you know, it's called capital controls. We call them capital account regulations. Is actually to give room of maneuver to do countercyclical macroeconomic policies. So, if I may say, our in that regard, there is a significant agreement with the IMF framework that these are instruments that are complementary to other macroeconomic policies to be able to do countercyclical management of the economy. Now, the principle that you know you have in the book in the box in page six in the leaflet you have in page four is a set of rules that we design as alternatives to those approved by the IMF. There is also actually a third set of guidelines, which was actually approved by the G20 in November in Cannes, which actually are interesting. I find themselves much better than the ones approved by the IMF. So the some of the ideas that we present there is, first of all, and perhaps most importantly, although the IMF presents this as a complement to macroeconomic policy, to countercyclical macroeconomic policy, it tends to see them as sort of interventions of last resort. So essentially, you do everything first. You know, you allow the exchange rate to appreciate. You you know, accumulate foreign exchange reserves. You do countercyclical fiscal policy, and then if you are still desperate, then you use you know, these regulations. Our point of view is that they really have to be designed as a package. So they really have to be there from the beginning. Also for a reason that I explain later. So they are not last resort interventions, they're really part of a normal policy package, in a sense, because you have limited effectiveness of traditional macroeconomic countercyclical policies, you have to use this instrument as a reinforcement of the countercyclicality of your macroeconomic policy. The second point that we make is that they must be different for countries that have opened the capital account than for countries that still have a closed capital account. So you have to design, you know, different sort of interventions. And they, of course, will refer to, you know, different characteristics of the interventions. For example, there is a bias in much of the work of the IMF against quantity-based regulations. So prohibitions, limits on lending, borrowing, et cetera, et cetera. And our point of view is that under certain conditions, quantitative-based regulations may actually be better than price-based regulations. Price-based regulations being taxes on capital inflows or outflows or, you know, reserve requirements of capital inflows or outflows. The additional point that we make is that, in a sense, we do support the idea of regulating inflows as the sort of normal intervention that most countries should have. But you could not limit the possibility of using regulations on outflows. And in fact, during this crisis, that proved very critical for some economies, notably Iceland, which is an interesting case because it was included in the conditionality of the IMF lending that they should have as a regulation on capital outflows. So there are many conditions in which actual regulation of capital outflows are important. And there are historical examples which are very important, such as the Malaysian regulations on outflows of the 1998, which are, you know, have been discussed extensively in the literature. The additional point that we make in regard to whatever regulation you have is that there are many loopholes, and financial agents will try to find the loopholes to avoid the the regulations. So any any intervention of this sort has to be extremely dynamic. As financial regulation in general has to be extremely dynamic to allow authorities to capture what are the loopholes and act on time to close those loopholes. And I think the history of any country that has very actively used these regulations is actually a history in which you by the practice of doing the regulation, you find out, you know, what is the next step because the financial agents are looking also at how to manage the regulations. And that, I think, leads to the issue of the administrative capacity of countries. So you have to have a good administrative capacity. And actually, a report of the IMF back in 2000 on this same issue came to the conclusion that one of the reasons why quantity-based regulations, such as prohibitions, for example, of certain transactions, is better is because they are easier to administer than price-based regulations. So under certain conditions, you actually want for administrative capacity just to, you know, to do something very simple and straight, like prohibiting certain types of transactions. You have more sophisticated system, then you can get into the Brazilian sophistication, let's say, of regulating capital inflows, or let's say Chilean and Colombia or Malaysia that did that in the past also. But in that case, again, the administrative capacity is nothing that you improvise. So you have to have a system in place in which you use it in a variable way through the business cycle. So in that regard, our basic point is that you have to have a permanent system in place that you manage in a countercyclical way. So you allow, you know, more capital inflows at certain times and less capital inflows at other times, depending on the conditions of the economy. And finally, there is a lot of discussion on whether, you know, you should discriminate only according to the currency of the transaction, the so-called foreign exchange related regulations. So you essentially, you regulate whether a domestic agent can use a foreign exchange or domestic currency for certain transactions. So that's one sort of regulation. For instance, Peru is a very well-known example of that form of regulation, but most countries actually use some form of foreign exchange related regulation. Or you discriminate according to the residence. There is a general statement that when you discriminate according to the residence, which is the regulations usually called capital controls, you are discriminated against foreigners. That actually is a wrong perception, because most of the time you actually discriminate against domestic residents with that. For instance, you don't allow them to move capital abroad. It's a typical, you know. So it's not clear that, you know, you're discriminating. Sometimes you discriminate against foreigners, and you sometimes discriminate against domestic residents. But the point is that, you know, in practice, it's very difficult to differentiate between the two. Because look at for the simple reason that foreigners have a tendency to demand more foreign currency, and domestic residents have a tendency to demand more domestic currencies. When you discriminate according to the currency, you are actually also discriminated according to the residence. So the distinction between the two is really not that important in practice, and you should simply use, you know, this in a complementary way, depending on the circumstances, together actually with the third family of macroprudential regulations, which are just, aimed at management in a countercyclical way. The domestic financial system.
Thank you, José Antonio. Stephanie?
Thank you very much, and thank you, Kemal, for giving us the opportunity of presenting the results. It's been a great pleasure to work with Kevin and Jose Antonio on this important issue. I will address more the issues of international dimensions and source country dimensions. One of the conclusions of our task force was that we came out in favor for bodies like the IMF, the G20, the Financial Stability Board, to play a role in reducing the stigma attached to capital account regulations and encourage countries to regulate capital flows when this is appropriate for reducing systemic risk, either within their countries or internationally. Look at these controls as a way of mitigating the likelihood of crises and reducing the magnitude if they occur. And I think I would like to stress a point that actually Jose Antonio Ocampo has been making for a long time, that there has been a bit of an asymmetry in that after the big crisis or the current crisis, there has been a lot of discussion of domestic financial regulation, particularly from a macroprudential point of view, but there hasn't been equivalent emphasis on regulation of cross-border capital flows. And they are in many ways two parts of the same coin. And if we are in favor, as we have to be, of better domestic financial regulation, we should also see in an integral part the regulation of capital controls as equally important. And this is, of course, consistent with the original design of the IMF, which was conceived by Keynes and White in their original design as not only permitting but also helping enforce capital account regulations, and seeing this as a core component of the IMF. This is, of course, very different with how the IMF later implement these things. And Keynes said that the control of capital movements inward and outward should be a permanent feature of the international financial system. And if one reads, for example, Keynes' biography by Skidelsky, you can see how different the nature of the discussion was to what it became later and to which it's returning now. And I think one point I would like to highlight, which I think is not emphasized enough when people are analyzing the European crisis, is that there are a lot of similarities here with the way crises have happened in emerging countries. Because in emerging countries, we have seen a series of crises in the past, and we have understood that volatile and reversible capital flows have played a major role in them. And this is not often enough emphasized in the case of Europe, because in Europe also a lot of the problems arising in Greece and Spain and Ireland are very closely linked to major capital flows, mainly intra-European ones, from German, British, French banks lending to these European periphery countries, or so-called periphery countries. And so the role of capital flows in that and the reversal is also very important and perhaps underplayed. Getting closer to the subject I want to emphasize is that both Keynes and White in these discussions at Bretton Woods highlighted that capital controls should be targeted at both ends, not just in the recipient countries, but also possibly in the resource countries. And one final point of a general kind I wanted to make is to say that recently, after all this work that Keynes and others had done in the past, there's a growing literature by people like Corinne Eck and Olivier Jean and others, John Williamson, which are beginning to do rigorous theoretical analysis to show that that capital flows are a strong imperfection, and that therefore rigorous capital controls can actually correct the market imperfection. And the capital controls are therefore not a distortion, but a measure that corrects capital flows inefficiency. Now the key point I want to stress, which complements the points that Kevin and Jose Antonio have made, is that the measures taken by developing countries to discourage inflows could be complemented by actions taken in developed countries, in the source countries, to discourage capital outflows and excessive risk-taking in emerging markets. And that this would have a sort of win-win effect, because developed countries, and particularly the U.S., increasingly also Europe, have been engaging in quantitative easing, that is, an expansion of monetary policy at an unprecedented scale accompanied to very low interest rates. And the aim of these measures is to try and reactivate credit in their economies. And they have not been terribly successful at that, perhaps a little bit more in the U.S., but certainly not in Europe. And a lot of those funds and of that risk-taking has instead left the developed countries and gone to emerging countries like Brazil, which have relatively higher interest rates, higher projected growth rates, and they have therefore contributed to a surge in capital flows during much of the post-crisis period. And this is, of course, it's bad for countries like the U.S. and the European economies who are printing all this money because they want the credit creation so it can help reactivate growth and investment and employment in their countries, but at the same time bad for the emerging economies who are suffering from the typical problems of too strong exchange rates, overheating of asset prices, and so on, and which may in the future lead to systemic risk and risk of crisis in them. So the argument which we made in the specific paper that I did with Kevin, and it's an argument that I have been doing for a long time. I previously did it with Jane DeRista, even in the late 90s, is that it would in many ways be a win-win to have also some kind of measures, and this is a little bit controversial, in the developed countries. And that one could, for example, think in terms of taxing in particular measures like the carry trade, which would be so targeting more short-term flows. There could be a tax both on spot and on derivative transactions going to emerging countries. And everybody says, oh, it's so difficult to tax derivatives, but it's very interesting, as was mentioned by the previous speakers, that actually Brazil has begun quite successfully to tax derivatives inflows. So if the Brazilians can do it, maybe the U.S. could have the technical know-how to do that as well. And so one could think in terms of these kind of measures that would both target, if you like, physical capital flows that go through the money and the credit supply channel, as well as the equivalent derivatives transactions. And this could then discourage, such a tax could discourage excessive risk-taking in the emerging markets and could encourage more of the monetary creation and of the risk creation to stay within the U.S. economy and within the European economy, which would then help reactivate growth. And this, of course, probably needs to be accompanied by some institutional measures in the U.S. and in Europe, such as creating vehicles to channel monetary creation into more productive sectors. A further advantage of doing such measures through taxation is, A, that it gives you more enforcement mechanism. One of the things that we learned at a seminar that José Antonio and I organized in Rio was that that taxation, as the Brazilian authorities saw it, is very useful for enforcement, because if you evade taxation, you can even go to jail. And so, therefore, it's quite useful way of ensuring capital of implementing capital controls through the taxation channel. And, of course, particularly in the U.S. and in Europe, very interesting, having more taxation is always a good thing if you have massive budget deficits and very large fiscal debt. So that should be another attractive reason. So the conclusion would be that there is this potential win-win, whereby one could start thinking also of complementary capital controls on the source countries. And the final point here is that this would be very helpful to emerging markets, because it's very hard for emerging markets when they even though they have a battery of instruments to try and manage capital flows, because they get overwhelmed when there are substantial easing of monetary policy, as is the case now and as has occurred in previous episodes. The wall of money going towards emerging markets can be very, very large indeed. And a small emerging country faced with this large wall of money finds it very difficult to resist, and this creates all sorts of distortions. So this kind of regulation in source countries could be a very valuable complement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and all three of you. Let me try to start the discussion maybe with two points. One is, we have, of course, here three panelists who fundamentally agree. And we don't have a panelist who would put the opposite view. So I was wondering whether at least one of you would want to comment on how somebody who argues for much freer capital flows would put their argument. Okay, in other words, you know, can you just comment a little bit on that? Any one of you who, I think Jose Antonio feels like he's willing to, I don't know. Anyway, I leave it up to you. But the other question, also the second question I'd like to bring in, is the relationship with exchange rate regimes. Because clearly the two questions are interlinked. And you haven't said anything about the, you know, what that implies for kind of exchange rate management. Mm. So those are two things, but I think it would be nice to start.
I'll do the argument against the exchange rate. Well, sure. Yeah. What's fascinating is that it's harder and harder to find folks making the argument against the use of capital account regulations. As I said before, there's this the IMF, which from the 1980s and, you know, through the Asian financial crisis, actually tried to change the Articles of Agreement of the IMF to require universal capital account liberalization across the world. But they're the ones who have come up with this new study from 2010 showing that those countries that used regulations were among the least hard hit, and actually going out there and requiring or suggesting the countries like India, Brazil, they even suggested to the Colombians that they put in place capital account regulations. And so the traditional place where you would find the folks who would be really antagonistic towards capital account regulations are many of the folks in the IMF, and they've really changed their tune. We really quibble with their sort of order of operations, but they're sort of on there. Where you still find the real concern are from special interests from the financial community. You noted that I was on a advisory committee to the State Department on investment treaties in the United States, and a number of us are very concerned about the extent to which U.S. trade and investment treaties restrict the ability of countries to regulate capital flows. And members of the Financial Services Committee in the United States, community in the United States, are very, very concerned, because obviously, if you're thinking about national welfare in a country, a government is going to say, well, the cost to a handful of firms are going to be outweighed by the benefits of avoiding a financial crisis. However, you know, obviously those losers do exist, and they continue to lobby against the use of capital account regulations, both in trade treaties, but in general at these venues of the G20. But it's harder to find mainstream economists in the United States and in other places around the world to argue against it. The arguments that have traditionally been there, you laid out. One is that they aren't very effective, and that they're easy to circumvent. But this new consensus, this econometric analysis, shows that they have been effective. But we actually address the circumvention issue, which is still a real issue for especially emerging market economies, with perhaps the exception of China. And it's easy for investors over time to be able to maneuver around a regulation, and that's why we stress the importance of being dynamic. And if you look at a country like Brazil, they've really been on the forefront. I think they've changed their capital account regulation something like seven times since 2009. First, they had a 2% tax on bond inflows and the stock market. And then they saw that investors were circumventing that tax by purchasing Brazilian stocks in the ADR market in the United States. And so they went to the ADR market and put a tax in place there. So that's an example of being dynamic. But we're not going to belittle the belittle that critique of the porousness of some of these regulations, but they can be overcome. But you have to be be dynamic. Another, we received a letter from Secretary Geithner, and another critique is that if you some are concerned that capital account regulations aren't as good as macroprudential regulations or reducing your fiscal deficit. Or accumulating reserves and or sterilizing and so forth, and that's true if you assume you're a developed country. But in developing countries with relatively weaker capital markets, that don't have the ability to regulate some of that, and if you have you can't change your fiscal deficit overnight. This is a legislative issue that can take months, and so if you're dealing with very short-term capital flows. Capital account regulation could be something that you put in place. And one thing that's also, my last point, is that many countries, if they have all those fundamentals in place, that's exactly what creates the herding mentality for the capital flows to come there at such a tumultuous rate in the first place. So if you have the right macro prudential regulations, if you have decent regulations for your financial sector, you have a tight budget deficit and so forth, or even a surplus, then you look very, very attractive in this structural environment, and then you might receive too much capital that you can handle.
Yeah. Let me refer to your second question. Actually, the issue of regulating capital flows or managing capital flows is inherently tied to the issue of worrying about the market giving or producing a wrong exchange rate. It's really the same issue at the same time. So when you think of when I was talking about countercyclical macroeconomic policy, which is the broader objective, and using capital account regulations, you are actually talking about the exchange rate management indirectly. And why is that? I mean, because one of the problems of booming capital inflows is that they generate, first of all, a tendency to appreciation to exchange appreciation in the recipient countries. And that exchange rate appreciation it generates, in a sense, two sort of problems. I mean, the first problem is a problem of macroeconomic stability. I mean, there will be a tendency to increase the current account deficit, and that's, let's say, to absorb the capital inflow, with domestic spending. And now that we know very well from history that, in developing countries, that is a strong indicator of a future crisis. And the best example now that we're looking throughout the world is actually the European periphery, which actually accumulated a large current account deficits and now is facing a problem, in that case, without the capacity to modify the exchange rate. Which has always been a room of a freedom, let's say, of countries that have their own currencies. That's the one effect. And the other effect is, of course, that there is significant evidence that if you, if in that process of exchange rate appreciation, certain domestic economic activities producing tradables, let's say, exportables, or goods that compete with imports, become less competitive, they may leave the business, let's say, and that will have long-term effects because once you destroy an economic activity, it's not easy to build it up again. So there's an asymmetry. So you destroy economic activities, the Dutch disease effect, let's say, then you'll not, you're hurting your long-term competitiveness and your long-term growth possibilities. And for that reason, you use, in a sense, some interventions. And I would say the basic choice you can think of a third choice, but, you know, in the past there was a lot of administration of the exchange rate. For instance, crawling pegs or other systems in which you actually try to smooth the exchange rate fluctuation. That is still in place, and some countries, notably Switzerland, has actually done some form of intervention in the exchange rate by putting a ceiling, let's say, on the value of the Swiss franc. But the other, which is generally what countries choose, is capital account regulations of some sort, or accumulation of foreign exchange reserves. And the point, and I think more countries prefer the second than the first. I mean, it's still, countries are a bit reluctant to use capital account regulations in general relative to foreign exchange interventions, which now have become essentially a normal practice throughout the emerging economies and developing countries. Now, the problem is that, accumulation of reserves is costly. And that's why you may prefer to do that. And I will add to that that the instruments may be complementary. For example, one of the criticisms the policy of increasing domestic interest rate in Colombia in 2006, 2007 is that there was a significant inflow of capital into the country. And then the central bank started to increase foreign exchange reserves to absorb that increased capital, which only increased further the capital inflows. So if you actually do a lot of foreign exchange rate interventions without capital account regulations, the cost of interventions may actually increase. So they actually should be used probably as complementary rather than as alternative instruments of intervention.
Senator, just to follow up, I mean, would you broadly say that in terms of exchange rate management, targeting in a flexible way the real exchange rate is the exchange rate regime that is closest to the kinds of things you propose on the capital account?
Yes, that's essentially what we have in mind, except that I would not pre-announce any targets. So, implicitly you have a target. But, I think the experience of announcing targets has been terrible at least in Latin America, they were really terrible in the past. So it's better never to announce an exchange rate target as such. But you can actually implicitly let it know to the market that, you think the exchange rate that the market has is wrong and try to intervene. And you have to be willing to do it the hard way, so as to convince the market that you mean what you say.
Stephanie?
Yeah, just very quickly, I wanted to compliment what Kevin had said on the arguments against the U.S. Mm-hmm. I think that the argument for efficient financial markets is getting very weak because the evidence is so strong that financial markets in particular are so inefficient. And that government intervention, however limited and however it may have its own imperfections, is much less imperfect than market imperfection in the case of finance. Stiglitz had made this point many years ago, actually, in a book, that it was in financial markets where government intervention was perhaps the most justified. And I think the series of crises has shown that this is so much the case. So the argument against regulation domestically and internationally has been weakened by empirical evidence and by theoretical work. The two problems, I think, which have both been pointed out by Kevin, one is that there are all these institutional arrangements whereby you're not allowed to have capital controls within the European Union, within the OECD, within the bilateral trade treaties. And so there is a, within the WTO. So then how are we going to think about adjusting the institutional arrangements to what we now understand both theoretically and empirically? And I think that is a big, big issue, because countries like even Chile are now constrained to have capital controls should they want to do it. And the second problem is, of course, the tremendous power of financial markets. I mean, I've been following a bit the negotiation of domestic financial regulation, say in the US and in Europe, and it is being permanently eroded by strong vested interests who depend on regulations not working for making monies, because they prefer, at least in the short term, freedom, so that they can then do what they like and make very large short-term profits, even though it may actually in the long term endanger their own institutions. So there is that problem of whether the power of governments and of public opinion can prevail over these very strong private interests of a very small section, even within the financial sector, but very powerful.
Let me ask a follow-up question. To what extent would this kind of flexible, unannounced, but nonetheless targeting of the real exchange rate in a kind of countercyclical fashion, to what extent is it compatible or not compatible with the kind of inflation targeting model?
Yeah, is the pure inflation targeting is obviously against any exchange rate targeting, but I believe for a long time that the pure inflation targeting is a wrong targeting for in general. You should at least have a target of economic activity, an employment or some other policy objective, and in emerging markets and developing countries, you should implicitly also have an exchange rate target of some sort. So it's multiple targeting, and that's why you know you have to have multiple instruments, and that's why you have to have capital account regulations, interventions in foreign exchange markets, you know, other macroprudential regulations in place to be able to manage the different objectives that you have in your policy. So I will agree with that. I think even from the point of view of inflation targeting, it may be contradictory not to have any exchange rate target. And for one simple reason, the lack of, let's say, if the exchange rate is totally flexible, you get a huge current account deficit during the boom, and then there is a sudden stop in external financing. Then what happens, you have a huge exchange rate depreciation. So you are actually reducing, and that exchange rate depreciation later on is a significant threat on the inflation target. So actually, even for a pure point of view of inflation targeting, it may make sense to have some exchange rate targeting in emerging markets. Anyway, but the concept is that I really believe in multiple objectives.
Multiple objectives, multiple instruments.
Yeah. And probably more instruments than objectives, because every instrument is limited. You have to have an overdetermined system. I mean, you have to have more instruments because each instrument is partially ineffective. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's open it to the floor now to questions. Let's start. Yes.
Karen Hood is former lawyer in the World Bank. One of the asymmetries is information and access to information. And my question is, how much information do you have about the magnitude and the sources of the capital flows? And then that comes back to the question about public interest versus private interest. To what extent do the ultimate citizens at the bottom of the financial food chain know anything about what's going on, let alone the regulators?
We'll take two or three questions and then, group. Yes, gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Peter Chawla from the Bretton Woods Project. Since I've had many discussions with the IMF executive directors as well on this topic, I might highlight one that they have complained about and get your response to it. They express a really ardent fear of financial protectionism developing into a rampant out-of-control phenomenon, and that's what they seem to be repeating to me over and over again. I want to hear your responses to that. The second question I wanted to ask was around your recommendations, which are very interesting, around the IMF providing better advice on how to design these controls, are interesting, but also they find opposition within some of the emerging markets. And I wanted you to comment on the issues of the lack of trust that some of those emerging markets have of the IMF and how that might be overcome.
Thank you. And the gentleman there, yes.
Thank you. Albert Keitel with the Atlantic Council of the United States and Georgetown. One on process. To what degree is there a wedge between, perhaps, the professional staff of the IMF and the political appointed leadership, in the sense that there may be more opportunity for pushback from the professionals against what are clear interests channeled through the U.S. Treasury Department and others to the IMF leadership, even at the time of appointment? And second, on the exchange rate question, is it just capital flows we're worried about, or is it quantitative easing also creating large demand for imports and therefore current account deficits on the part of, say, the United States that put pressure on countries that then have exports pulled out of them by that liquidity that causes pressures on their exchange rates? So I would like to see it perhaps treated as more of an overall liquidity issue controlled at the sources than just controls at the destinations. Thank you.
All right. Well, these are the first three questions, and we turn to the panel. I don't know how you want to organize yourselves. I mean, who answers what? I mean, let's start with Stephanie and then go the other way.
Okay, I'll start with the first question. Very interesting, the issue of information. I think when the process of kind of deregulation went to a very extreme position, there was not only the idea you shouldn't intervene with markets, but you didn't even need the information about how they worked. I remember taking some colleagues from the then Czechoslovakia to the Bank of England. They wanted to know what data they should record on capital flows, and they were told that they didn't really have to bother. You know, it was really, the markets were working so well. We at the Bank of England, they said, told us didn't really need data. Which I thought was absolutely crazy. And these continentals, like the French and the German, we were told, were unnecessarily gathering data. And I found that really quite scary from one of the largest financial centers of the world. I think the position has now changed. And a precondition for good regulation is information and transparency, both for the regulators and, I think, as you very rightly say, for the broader public. I think there's a sort of basic issue of democracy, which Kemal mentioned at the beginning, which is about the society understanding what is going on and then being able to regulate it. And if you don't have transparency and information, you just can't do it. And I think there's, of course, again, resistance from the financial interest groups because they say we don't want to disclose and so on. And I think that is one of the basic fights about. I think it can be done. I mean, countries that have had capital controls, effective ones like Colombia and Chile, have required to have good data, and it's perfectly possible. It's difficult, but it's a very good investment of resources. Spending, a couple of $100,000 on that, if it avoids you having a crisis that will cost you hundreds of billions of dollars, is a good investment. I think Peter's issue about financial protectionism, I don't know exactly what the IMF board means. Keynes always said, let trade and friendship and so on be international, let capital be homespun. Not always, but he emphasized that. I think the Bhagwati position that Kemal highlighted is a very interesting one. That one can make the case if you are committed to free trade flows, because perhaps that there are imperfections there, but the imperfections are smaller than the advantages. If capital flows are so disruptive for trade flows, as they can be by all these exchange rate misalignments and volatility and so on, then some control of capital, both domestic and international, may be seen as a way of facilitating actually free trade. And I think that is the reason why people like Bhagwati was very liberal on trade, are actually very open to capital controls. And so one could sell that as a way of supporting the market, which I think is actually quite true. The last question was about quantitative easing also encouraging exports from developing countries. I thought that was an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. But I think developing countries would be less worried about that, because if you're exporting your goods and services... Yes, yes. So it's Dutch disease through two channels. You're quite right. I think that's a very interesting point.
Any comments from...
No, let me actually complement the first... I mean, the question of information is very important. You have to have a good system of information. And part of the problem that we have today is that we have a very limited system of information on capital flows. And I just illustrated with one case, which I, for some reasons I'm studying, which is Puerto Rico. I don't know if you have ever seen a balance of payment of Puerto Rico, but the errors and omissions last year were more than 10% of GDP. Okay, that's when you don't have information. Okay, that's what happens. So it's impossible to analyze, you know, the dynamics of a, you know, balance of payment of a country. You don't have good information about capital flows. This was the same problem that we had in Latin America during the debt crisis. Mm. It just happened in the beginning of, there was no information in place. So the World Bank actually started a huge project to increase information about debt. So it's possible to get information. And the reason why it's possible is with the modern technology, you can actually have excellent monitoring of the nature of capital flows. After all, you know, in all this thing about the illicit money, flowing in the financial system, there's a huge system of information that has been put in place. So it's possible to have information on financial flows. I mean, and I think that's part of a sense of, even if you don't want to regulate, you want to know. I'm pretty sure Puerto Rico doesn't want to regulate capital flows, because after all, it cannot. You know, it's part of the. but at least to have information, so it. You can understand the dynamics of the economy by having the information. So it's possible to have information. I think with modern technology, it's actually very easy to get information. It's just a question of willingness to do that. And let's say on the last question of, let me say that, you know, I am in the camp of those who doesn't think the quantitative easing as such is the problem. The real problem is that, you know, what that is the low interest rates that have to prevail in industrial economies. Whether you do it quantitative easing or some other mechanism or operation twist of, you know, or any other innovation that you get into the system, you know, it's actually the end product of that is low interest rate. And I think the issue is the structural difference that we have today between the need of major industrial economies to keep interest rate extremely low, close to zero for the short-term rates, and the need for emerging economies to have much higher interest rate because they are actually growing. So that, you know, that structural difference, which is partly associated with quantitative easing, but partly associated with market phenomena, or partly associated with other policies, at the end is what matters. And I think we are living in an era now, in a period, let's say, in which if we are going to have that structural difference, I see no other way of managing that than capital account regulations of some sort.
I think most of the questions have been answered, but just a couple haven't. Let me add one thing on the information. One, there's information gaps for people like us who try to analyze it, but if you think about actual market participants, if they had more information about the nature of capital flows and the structure of their banking, they might make different market decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a small farmer in a rural environment, if they knew that the abundance of loans all of a sudden are being financed by short-term maturity mismatches from outside of the country, and they borrow all this money to grow all this product, thinking that 7 months down the road when the product is available that other folks will be taking out loans to buy that stuff to have inputs into their part of the production process. But if there's a sudden stop in the meantime because of the short-term volatile nature of the capital flows, that farmer made an incredibly bad decision that can affect their livelihood. I mean, that's a part of the information asymmetry that is a core component in addition to the analysis of it. And the answer to the to the to some of the folks you're speaking to at the International Monetary Fund is they should listen more to their own staff and to the economics profession. Is that there's this Olivier Jean from across the street, and Anton Kornak at Maryland, and Arvind Subramanian, who's a member of our task force, have done this real new innovative work in economic theory that shows that markets can indeed be inherently unstable. Mm. And I am a professor, so I'm going to say something that's nerdy, and that capital account regulations can be seen as a Pigouvian tax to correct for market failure. So rather than, I've said in the past, rather than this being financial protectionism, it's financial correctionism to correct markets and make them work better. And that goes to the other point that Al had about the wedge between the staff and the politics. It's gotten much more interesting recently because in the some of the emerging markets, the Brazilians, the Indians, and other countries that are strong and perhaps by Friday, when if the IMF managing director gets her $500 billion, even stronger, they are pushing for more thinking about capital account regulations. At the same time, where there's been a lot of staff turnover, the director of research at the staff commented on this report when we briefed the IMF a couple weeks ago, and they said they agree with everything in here. And so there's an interesting combination of sort of Western-trained economic staff in the IMF and many of the emerging market and developing country executive directors and so forth. But the United States has still been a bit of impediment, not only at the International Monetary Fund, but perhaps even more strongly, unfortunately, through the persistence of its position in trade and investment treaties on limiting the ability of countries to regulate cross-border capital flows.
Yes, there was. Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much. Marcel Fratscher from the European Central Bank. I have two questions that are related. The first one relates to what I was missing from your report relates to the issue of externalities. So as you mentioned rightly, there's evidence that capital controls can be effective in reducing capital inflows, but there's equally very strong evidence that the capital that does not go into countries because of capital controls will go elsewhere. And you mentioned Brazil several times and the capital controls there. So we have evidence that the capital controls in Brazil were effective, but at the same time that they diverted capital inflows to other Latin American economies. So clearly there is an issue of negative externalities of capital controls, and this is really a very strong case for international coordination, something that I understand you're not very favorable of. So I would very much like to hear your reaction to that externality issue. You can bring it a step further. There's this issue of currency wars that was raised by the Brazilian finance minister last year. And you can make the same point about capital controls, right? Countries or central banks intervening to keep their currencies from appreciating, that very much leads to a race of the bottom for ever more interventions precisely to deal with capital inflows. And so there's a very strong case for coordination, and I would be very curious to hear your view on international coordination of capital controls. Second question very briefly is, if you take a longer-term perspective and you think of China and India, two largest emerging market economies, China being almost entirely closed in its capital account and India partially, if you take a longer-term perspective, wouldn't you think that, would the world be better, or let me put it as a question, would the world be better off if countries like China and India were open to capital accounts, to capital flows, and therefore the pressure of capital flows globally would be spread across more countries and across more markets, or would you rather see that they're doing it the right way?
Interesting question. Yes?
Yeah, hi. Great, really helpful. And clear presentations. I appreciate it. I'm Tim Wise from the Global Development Environment Institute at Tufts University and the Triple Crisis blog. And I wanted to follow up on the point Kevin made about what emerges from the panel to me is that, you know, the world has changed, right? Since the financial crisis, the world has changed. And in the developing world, they've recognized that. And everyone's experimenting and employing these capital account regulations. And the IMF and other institutions have recognized that change. And the resistance to new regulations in the new financial economic environment is coming largely from countries like our own. Kevin's point about the resistance in trade and investment treaties is interesting, and now is the time with the committee that you sat on, right, the model bilateral investment treaty, the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I just wonder if you could say something more about, you know, Obama vows to negotiate the trade agreement for the 21st century and how that jives with this new world of financial regulation, post-crisis financial and economic management.
A question here.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Yana Gritter-Savai. I'm faculty at University of California, visiting Georgetown and SAIS. I would have two questions, if I can. In your introductory remarks, one of you mentioned the origins of the Bretton Woods system, which we know allowed capital controls in combination with fixed regimes. We also witnessed recently some calls for return to fixed exchange regimes by Robert Mundell and other people as a way to reduce global macroeconomic balances caused by excessive volatility of exchange rates. So I'd like to hear your views on these proposals for new forms of international financial governance of return to new Bretton Woods system. And the second question or a comment would be, I guess I haven't heard from you the need to combine controls on capital flows with the need to develop financial system, domestic financial sector, which would be able to withstand, capital flows and benefit from flows, directing them to productive uses. So I would also grateful comment on this because it's a very important, complement of capital controls.
All right. We have three, again, very good questions, and we'll turn to Jose Antonio. Why don't you start this one, and then Kevin, and then Stephanie.
Well, let me refer to, let me start with the target zones, with my colleague Robert Mundell's obsession with fixed exchange rates. I think the it's simply an impossible system. That's what I have pointed out to him many times without any success, and many people have, actually. So, it really returning to the original Bretton Woods system would be simply impossible, particularly because that system assumed limited capital flows. And it was a world with limited capital flows. With the amount of capital flows that we have today, that system would be impossible. Witness the, just the crisis within Europe, to understand that, which is a very major challenge, and I'll refer to the question by, our colleague from the European Central Bank. But I think a significant part of the intra-European problem was actually, inter-country mobility of capital that allow, very similar problems, excessive financing of current account deficits that turn out to be unsustainable. A reduction of risk spreads to limits that the market did not capture the effective risk of different countries. And so it's very similar phenomena to that we have observed in emerging markets in the past. That, that during booms, there is so much capital inflow that, any current account deficit seems sustainable or financeable, at least in the short term. And then it turns out, that was not true. And second, that the risk premium tend to decline so much during booms that, again, doesn't capture the amount of risk involved in lending to some countries. So it's a similar phenomenon. On a totally fixed exchange rate regime. So I think my colleague Mundell in this has been wrong for a long time. Actually, I think the much better system that is consistent with my view is a system, for example, that John Williams, we're going to conference in his honor just after this across the road here, of the issue of target zones as a system for, let's say, the post-Bretton Woods. And I think we should probably think of a target zone system. And that leads me to the externality question, because in a sense, yes, we need coordination. And I say, I will start by saying, in some form of exchange rate coordination through target zone, which has been, you know, was proposed in the early 1970s, have been proposed since then, you know, on several occasions by people like John Williamson and others, is probably a system of to have more macroeconomic policy coordination. Now, should we have that for capital flows? And I would say probably we should have minimal rules of intervention. For example, I find that, you know, some reserve requirement on capital flows should actually be a normal international rule. You should also have other, you know, universal regulations. For example, don't allow currency mismatches for agents that cannot manage currency mismatches, which has been a major problem, by the way, also in Europe, with non-euro members in the European Union and in the candidate countries, let's say, for the European Union. So I really think that you should have some form of regulation of coordination. But that has to start by recognizing that regulation of cross-border capital flows have to be conceived as normal business. Mm. because what I find totally, my chapter here starts by pointing out, actually, that it's very paradoxical that after the global financial crisis, it was accepted as normal that you should regulate finance. But then you took out of that world of G20 promotion of regulation of finance, cross-border finance. I mean, it's as if cross-border finance was not finance and nothing that you had to regulate. So intra-country finance, oh, yes, do a lot of regulation. But if it's cross-border, don't touch that. That's not the subject of regulation. That's, in my view, a totally inconsistent view of financial regulation. Financial regulation has to include cross-border finance because that's part of finance.
On the ECB comment, I think we mustn't have been as clear as we should be, because we definitely do encourage cooperation, both sort of south-south cooperation and north-south cooperation. But we also point out how difficult it is on political reasons, but also because of these institutional barriers related to trade treaties. So if you look at Latin America, one of the regions that was pummeled the most with this tsunami of capital inflows from 2009 to 2011, the countries that were hit the hardest were Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and Mexico. Mexico and Chile both have trade treaties with the U.S., and they both are members of the OECD, and the codes of liberalization in the OECD say that you can't regulate capital flows. Colombia at the time was negotiating a treaty with the U.S. Brazil is the only country that hasn't liberalized a lot of its cross-border flows under the GATS, and as a matter of policy, does not engage in bilateral investment treaties and free trade agreements that have that kind in there. So cooperation is important. The article by Arvind Subramanian in the piece really pushes for south-south cooperation. The article that Steffi and I wrote really talks about north-south cooperation. But as the world has emerged to realize that we need to regulate cross-border finance and that this stuff is important, we've woken up and realized that we've sort of tied knots around the Articles of Agreement of the International Monetary Fund that gave us the leeway to do that. And the Brazils of the world have that leeway. The Indias of the world, the Chinas of the world have that leeway. But many of the smaller countries that have engaged in the competitive liberalization and free trade treaties have taken that off. No one answered, or Jose Antonio didn't answer your question about India and China. Yes, when India and China, when they have open capital accounts, the world will be a better place somewhere in between 2035 and 2050. We're talking about a third of the world's people, and we've noticed every country that opens up its capital account too quickly. Mexico, Russia, Colombia, Chile, Brazil, Thailand, I can list 100 of them, they all have a crisis. And not to belittle these relatively smaller countries, but look what happens when Brazil and Russia did these things too quickly, and massive crises that rippled across the world. You have one of these crises in Brazil or excuse me, in China or India, you you have a global problem that is of significant nature, and these countries don't have, especially in the case of China, deep capital markets, the right kind of institutions, and so forth. Right? We are far away, and the PBOC just released a report where they say that they're going to liberalize fully in the next 15 years, and you know that's a recipe for a real problem. In the academic literature, we now see that there is not a relationship between capital account liberalization and economic growth and financial stability for developing countries. And what we're debating now is what's the threshold? Eswar Prasad and Coase and Kenneth Rogoff are really at the forefront of this literature. If you Google, you know, the threshold literature, we're trying to figure out what is the threshold, and we think it might be in GDP per capita terms somewhere around $20,000 GDP per capita. So even at fast rates of growth, the Indias and the Chinas of the world would be should be highly cautious of liberalizing going anytime in the short term. With respect to the trade treaties, it's interesting. The Bush administration started to be a little bit more flexible in terms of capital account regulations and trade treaties, just a tad. And all signs from the one treaty that the Obama administration has initiated on its own, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They have not been forthcoming with any of the text, which is also not very traditional from the U.S. perspective. We all get a chance to usually see what we're negotiating about. I did have the opportunity to be on a commission where some of us made recommendations specifically on this point to sort of let trade work by being able to regulate capital flows. There was a lot of stiff opposition on that commission. The Obama administration hasn't come out officially by saying that they're going to change their course. But we know from conversations with Malaysian negotiators and New Zealand negotiators and Australian negotiators that the text that the U.S. has on offer in the Trans-Pacific Partnership is actually worse than the Bush administration's in terms of making it more difficult to regulate cross-border finance.
All right. We still have a little bit of time.
Can I
say yes, sure.
Briefly. I just wanted to also our ECB colleague just to compliment briefly. I mean, going back to the European crisis, it's very interesting that, for example, Spain had a current account deficit of about 10% of GDP for a very long period of time. It actually had very good fiscal management. It had till 2007 actually fiscal surplus. But it had this very large current account deficit. And I remember asking many years ago, a Spanish economist, and they were not worried. They said, well, we're part of the EU, and we're just very easy. It's like California. But, of course, it's not like California because it's not a common fiscal policy, the same kind of labor mobility. And so, therefore, I think that there is a problem of capital flows, as José Antonio and I have pointed out, as a key element of the European crisis. And what can be done about that is a difficult question. And I think we have, and also the point that José Antonio made earlier about you need to regulate mismatches of currency at a minimum. It was very interesting. We were at a conference with a former Hungarian deputy of the central bank, and she said, well, we were almost in the euro. That's why we weren't concerned about currency mismatches. And so they borrowed. The households were borrowing in Swiss francs and in euros, but they didn't have the euro yet. And of course, this is also a very important element of the crisis. So how does one coordinate your very interesting question, regulation? I think not just on the capital account, but also macroprudential. Because if you could have a very good macroprudential regulation, say, in developing countries or in European countries, and then if the U.S. has a party and has very irresponsible, say, credit creation. You can have a repeat of the crisis that we've just had. So although even regulations that are of national origin need to be coordinated, I think, internationally. I think as regards capital account, the problem is that the developing countries don't trust the IMF to be, if you like, and this came out very clearly in our task force, The Indians, the Brazilians wouldn't want the IMF with its current structure of governance, and even though it has moved in some direction, to be a monitor. So there may have to be more ad hoc coordination. And on your second point, which is also very interesting about opening the capital account of China and India, I very much agree with Kevin that we have to be very careful, because not just in this recent crisis, but also in the East Asian crisis, thank God for China's capital account. It was, you know, even the U.S. authorities are very grateful that, that China was such an anchor of stability in the East Asian crisis. And even more now, I mean, they are the ones who are helping, who are going to help fund Europe, hopefully, and so on. And I think from a national perspective, but also from a global perspective, the way China and India liberalize a capital account is of crucial importance, because, of course, if they were to have a currency or a banking crisis, it would be so costly in terms of poverty creation within their own countries, and it would be so disruptive systemically for the world economy, that I think we as a world economy have a very strong interest in asking the Chinese to be extremely careful in their capital account liberalization. This is not the message that the investment bankers are taking to Beijing or to Delhi, but I think it is a message that should come out from sort of policy-oriented people who are looking more at the sort of broader public good.
Okay. Two more questions, and then we'll, yeah. Gentleman here and at the back.
I'm Jerry Norris with the Hudson Institute here in Washington, D.C. We publish annually a report on the U.S. net economic engagement with the developing world. And in 2010, the total from everything starting with official development assistance down through foundations, corporations, U.S. private capital flows was $326 billion. And of that amount, $161 billion was U.S. private capital flows. But other capital flows were $131 billion. In some years, like 2008, the U.S. private capital flows were negative, but the other capital flows were $100 billion plus. So since capital, is there any thought of regulating all capital flows? Thank you.
At the back, yes, sir.
Public. Claudia Farris, Catalyst Institute for Applied Policy. My question relates to the difference between a tax on derivatives that would be based in America versus dollar denominated, and how you would do these capital flows, these capital controls, other than internationally. So I'm a person in Istanbul doing a dollar denominated trade in the Japanese market. And there is a tax on derivatives in the United States. Hello. So my question is, how does that work?
All right. Final comments.
Well, I counted over 100 people here at one point, and it's dwindling quick. I think the only people who are here are the ones in the front, because you feel like you're being rude. So I'm just going to say, if for those of you who stayed, maybe you're liking this conversation. If you can come at 3:30 this afternoon at the World Bank IMF Civil Society meetings, and I'll be talking about this report more in depth there, as will the Bretton Woods Project. Latindad also have similar reports with, and so we can continue this conversation there. I'll defer the rest of my minutes to my friends here at the table.
Yeah. On the last question, I think one of the most interesting chapters here is by Charles Spiegel from the UN on the issue of circumventing regulations. How to do about them, and it has a very interesting comments on derivatives. I would say one of the big problems even of research on this issue is the relation between onshore markets and offshore markets with the specific currencies, actually. And this is a very important issue in regulation. I mean, one of the biggest tests of Malaysia back in 1994 when they were having a boom in financing was actually to cut short
to cut the link so that offshore trade in Singapore did not have implications for transactions in Malaysia. If I may say the I am of the view that it depends on whether then the derivative is deliverable or not deliverable, let's say in technical terms, so that she discusses when there is a capital flow anyway, because there are cases in which you don't have the capital flow, so the regulation is actually effective when you did it onshore. But of course, you can never regulate offshore markets. I mean, you can cut the link between the two. And actually, one of the good information that you have on effectiveness of capital controls is actually the difference between onshore and offshore markets. My last point is that the existence of that of those offshore markets is what makes one form of regulation of coordination useful. Which is the possibility of, of supporting regulations by countries that do adopt regulations by other countries. So if a country feels that because of its financial instability, it has to regulate capital flows, somehow there should be some form of cooperation by other countries where the offshore market is located. It's not an easy question, but I would say that's part of the what cooperation would mean in this case. Certainly the U.S. doesn't seem to be willing to do that, but at the same time, the U.S. has just to mention that has been the big push behind cooperation in illicit capital flows. So if that is one thing in which many developing countries have got into cooperating with the U.S. On illicit capital flows. I actually was a finance minister when we started the cooperation with the U.S. Treasury, exactly on that point, which was very critical for the U.S. and, of course, very critical for Colombia. And I said we started to collaborate in that regard. But that's one very particular business of cooperation that could actually be extended to other areas. And other areas that relate to the financial stability, which is, after all, why you do regulation in finance.
Yeah, can I just complement that briefly? I think this is a very important point about evasion. Sharish Spiegel's article shows that, for example, the costs to evasion. So it depends how costly the regulation is. Or the taxation compared to the cost of evading it, because it takes you a lot of time to set up alternatives to evade regulation. The other issue is that you have certain taxes that work very well. For example, in the UK, you have a stamp duty, which is paid not just by British residents, but by anybody who trades stocks and shares, UK stocks and shares. And in fact, 40% of the tax is paid by foreigners, by non-residents. And it has worked very well for decades, if not hundreds of years. And it raises about over $3 billion a year. So you can actually do this. And you can do it more now because a lot of the transactions have been going since the Hoechstra collapse, but even more since the global financial crisis. A lot of transactions, including derivatives, are now being pushed on the exchanges through clearing houses. And by doing that, you have a record of the transaction. And so therefore, it's much easier to add a little algorithm of a tax, which you could even vary, which can contribute to discouraging capital control. So as José Antonio says, it is difficult, but it is possible. If you find the willingness of countries to do it, as the U.S. has done for illicit flows, both for terrorism and for drug money, you can actually get it done. And we have a lot of cases. And, I don't like this concept that somehow the markets are like a tsunami. They're like beyond us. They are, after all, human constructs. And we can bring back the power. If we want to, they use computers, but so do regulators, so do tax authorities. So if we have collaboration between governments, and if we have well functioning clearing houses, there is no reason why these things cannot be implemented.
Right. I think that if we have cooperation is an important part of the story. Anyway, thank you very much. This was a wonderful discussion. Thank you. Thanks to you.